if the purpose of the Torah is to tell us a story, then either it left us off in the middle of the story last week, or right when we got to, you know, the climax and the interesting part of it, it cuts off and says, okay, to be continued next week, in order to keep our attention. All of us raised on television certainly appreciate this approach. And apparently it's been working for years, bringing Jews back after reading Bullock. Now, let's just back up a little bit and then we'll see exactly what we're up to. And the truth is, there's only really two verses in this week's portion I want to focus on. Last week, through the whole beginning, middle, and almost the end, was about this plot which was put together to try to destroy the Jewish people. Instead of attacking us physically by war, the plot was to curse us. There seems to have been a clear understanding that the Jews are a people of spirit, and therefore they need to be attacked on a spiritual level. Eventually, by the time we get to the end of the portion, we find that either a different plan was hatched or something else happened, but it seems to be that this was conscious and planned. And we're told that what the soldiers of other countries had failed at was accomplished by the quote-unquote cheerleaders of Midian, or Moab. It starts with Moab and ends up with Midian. We're told that the Jews began to be corrupt with the daughters of Moab. They followed them in their practice of idolatry. And the connotation over here is one where there seems to have been outrage, both in terms of idolatry and in terms of sexuality. At the very end, we're told of one particular individual who takes this woman and stands in front of the congregation, and very demonstrably, he decides that he is going to take her. And there is confusion. People are upset, crying. And then we're told that a man rises up from among the community. His name is Pinchas. And Pinchas takes a sword, and he kills the two of them on the spot. And that brings an end to the plague. On the other hand, we're told that in this plague, some 24,000 people die. That's the end of last week's portion. This week's portion comes back and revisits the story. And among the things that it adds in, it tells us that this person, this unidentified man, was not just anyone. He happened to be a leader of one of the tribes, a prince of one of the tribes. This woman, by the way, was not just anyone. She happened to be the daughter of one of the leaders of Midian, the head of one of the families. And the person who stood up was Pinchas. Without getting into the issues such as, you know, in terms of our current moral basis, in terms of the sensibilities and sensitivities of modern people, perhaps people would feel that this is somewhat unfortunate. Pinchas made a value judgment. He acted on it. He had no right to. And by the way, the truth is that among rabbinic sources, there's all kinds of debates about this, but let's push this aside. The Jews were involved, or they were engaged in this episode in sexual licentiousness and idolatry. The Talmud tells us there's a very close correlation to the two. Pinchas acts. As a result, he's told the following things. It says, "Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Lemer," God spoke to Moshe, saying, "Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen," Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron the Kohen, Hishiv es chamosi me'al b'nei Yisrael. He has succeeded in stopping God's anger against the Jewish people. Bikano es kinosi b'socham, whereby he had this jealousy, as it were. V'lo kilesi b'nei Yisrael b'kinosi, and I, God says, did not destroy the Jewish people in my anger. Which means is that Pinchas was able to identify with the anger that God had and was able to act and therefore to quell that anger. Lachain emor, therefore say, Hineni nosein lo es brisi shalom. I am therefore going to give him my covenant of peace. V'yisalo l'zarach harav brisku nas olam. And he and his descendants afterwards will have a covenant of being the Kohanim, the priests, forever. Tachas asher kinei le'elokov, because he was jealous for God. Ve'chaper b'nei Yisrael, and he brought about forgiveness for the Jewish people. So let's go from simple to more complex. First of all, what it sounds like he did was he already acted as a Kohen. Now, by the way, that's not a simple point. What's a Kohen? What does a Kohen do? A Kohen is somebody who works in the temple. A Kohen is known as a priest. What the priest would do is that if the Jews have sinned, the priest would help heal the relationship between man and God. In this particular instance, the relationship between man and God has become stressed. Pinchas understands what the source of this is. He moves in, he acts, and what are we told? That the relationship between God and man is healed. Which means, in a sense, Pinchas acted as a Kohen, and as a reward for acting as a Kohen, what reward does he get? He therefore becomes a Kohen. That's on a very simple level, what I just now said. And it's very likely or possible that Rashi would be happy with the way that I just now explained it. But let's start all over again, and what I'm going to ask right now may be unfair because it's going to necessitate a little bit of knowledge. Was Pinchas a Kohen before this?
No.
Okay, so I see once again numerous among you have been indoctrinated. How do you know that Pinchas was not a Kohen?
I would say yes.
How do you know Pinchas was not a Kohen? Yes?
Because the time said you Aaron and your sons, and that time Pinchas was already born, he was a grandson. So if it only said him and his sons, you know, the future sons will be born, that's fine, but he's already living.
So as I said, you've been indoctrinated. If you would have read that verse, that any other knowledge, and it said you and your sons, what would you have thought? Right, so then why are you telling me he's not?
Because.
Yes?
The whole paragraph talks about the reward of Pinchas. If there's already a Kohen, where's the reward? All you're doing is reaffirming what's already there.
Okay, perhaps. But your question is based upon the assumption that the reward that he receives is he becomes a Kohen. You know what? Let's make this easier then. We see that we've already gotten you sufficiently confused, or someone beat me to it. There are two covenants that are mentioned over here. One is a covenant of peace, and one is a covenant of being a Kohen. I'll read the Hebrew again. It says, "Briti shalom, v'ital lo lezarach harav brit kunat olam." The covenant of being a Kohen forever. By the way, I can easily say for the forever is the present over here. I don't have to say that being the Kohen is the present. I'm just saying it's not as simple as you're stating it. But are we dealing over here with one covenant or two covenants? Which means over here when it says that the covenant of priests and the covenant of being a Kohen, does it sound over here like we're speaking of one or two separate things? You see, it's true that Rashi assumes that he's not a Kohen. Rashi's logic is probably exactly the way that you just now stated it. That if he was already a Kohen, then why would he receive the blessing of a Kohen? So therefore it must be that he wasn't a Kohen, now he becomes a Kohen. Other commentaries look at it somewhat differently. For example, there is a law that states that a Kohen that kills becomes invalidated as a Kohen. So now I can say I have a problem. Let's say Pinchas was a Kohen. And now he killed. So what just now took place? He's no longer a Kohen. So now why would God have to come and say, no, I'm going to make you a Kohen forever? Because he was invalidated. So what is this then? This would then be the rehabilitation of Pinchas the Kohen. Okay, does that work? There's somebody who died 800 years ago named the Riva who says that's exactly what happened. By the way, the Zohar says that he wasn't a Kohen till now. Why wasn't he a Kohen? Because God knew that he would kill. And therefore, had he been a Kohen and he killed, he would have been invalidated. So now he was held out from being a Kohen in order to allow him to be heroic over here and therefore become a Kohen afterwards, which is a very delicious interpretation. Yes?
I was kind of thinking, before you said that, which makes a lot of sense, I was kind of thinking that maybe it was like the reward for the mitzvah is the mitzvah itself.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the reward for acting like a Kohen, and, you know, even though he is a Kohen, is, you know, the pleasure of continuing to be a Kohen.
Right, correct. And that's why I framed it in that way, is that the purpose of a Kohen is to bring about, is to rehabilitate the relationship between man and God. So over here, that's what he does. So therefore, if he acts like a Kohen, he becomes Kohen. And then that becomes a very nice way of looking at it. Who's the quintessential Kohen?
Aaron.
And why is Aaron the Kohen? See, here you can't tell me because his father was a Kohen. God makes him a Kohen. So when does God make Aaron the Kohen? Before you start telling me all kinds of rabbinic interpretations, at which point does he become Kohen? Yeah.
At which point?
Yes.
When Moshe puts the oil on his head?
I intimidated you to change what you were going to say. I know what you're going to say. Did I tell you what you're going to say?
No, I was going to say he became a Kohen when Moshe was arguing so long. Correct. With Hashem.
Correct. And then he says, your brother, Aaron, Halevi, is coming. He says that now he's a Levi, but he'll become a Kohen because of you. Correct. Because you refuse to be a leader for the people, he'll eventually become Kohen. So correct, there is an interpretation. Ladies, there are more chairs. If you... Okay. That means that he is, according to that interpretation, the fact that Aaron would become a Kohen is already been forecasted long before the Jews even leave Egypt. Correct, there is a teaching like that. But when does Aaron actually become Kohen? It's not until Moshe goes up the first time to bring down the tablets, comes down the first time, goes up the second time, comes down the second time, and only afterwards when the instructions are given to build the Mishkan, within the instructions of building the Mishkan, then also we have instructions to make him into a Kohen, which therefore means Aaron doesn't actually become Kohen until after Moshe comes down from the mountain the second time. Now, why is that interesting? So I'll tell you why it's interesting. Because in between the event that you pointed out, when Moshe is still arguing with God, and basically when God tells him, I want you to lead the Jewish people, Moshe says, what, me? You know, who am I to lead the Jewish people? I'm not, you know, I'm inadequate, it's not appropriate, there are better people. I mean, and he keeps looking for all kinds of reasons why he should not actually be the leader, which by the way, is not theoretically a bad thing. Is it a bad thing to be humble? Is it a bad thing to, no. What's the problem? If God says, I'm sending you on a mission, it's a little more difficult to be humble. Because what is God saying? God is saying, I got your back. And if God has your back, then you really don't have to... Meaning, God's not saying, Moshe, I need you to go do a job for me. He's saying, I'm going to do it. I just want you to be the one who physically walks in over there. Which means that itself is enough reason to do it. And there's a second point. It's one thing to be humble when all things are equal. Let me ask you a question. Let's say that there are two of you who are lifeguards, and there's somebody who's drowning in a pool. And I say, is there a lifeguard? You go, yes, I'm a lifeguard. And I say, can you jump in and try to save him? You say, listen, there are better lifeguards over here. Who am I? There are better people than me. Which means if somebody's drowning, that's not the time for humility. Somebody's drowning, you got to get him out. When Moshe refuses, and every second he's refusing, and not me, and they're better people, the Jews are still slaves. They're still being beaten. They're still suffering an incredible amount of indignity. Which means, again, it's one thing to be humble on your time. It's another thing where your humility is going to directly lead to the suffering of other people. You get my point? So when you combine that together with God telling him to do it, that's why we have an opinion that says that Moshe was originally supposed to become the Kohen Gadol as well. Not just was he supposed to be the leader to take him out of Egypt, he also was destined to be the high priest. Now the truth is, he becomes the high priest, but only for a limited amount of time, for the first 7 days when the temple is actually built, when the Mishkan is actually built. But afterwards he loses that position and Aaron takes over. So as I said, there's a rabbinic teaching. The reason that he lost the position was because he protested too much about being the leader for the people. And basically God is saying, so you don't want to be a leader for the people? Fine, I'll replace you as Kohen Gadol. I'll find someone else to take that position. Very good. So then you have a wonderful parallel between Moshe and between Pinchas. But again, you get to the same explanation. At the point that Moshe killed somebody, he wasn't a Kohen. So he wasn't a Kohen, so that would not necessarily invalidate him. Okay, so the point is well taken. Now, let's go back again. Somewhere between the time where Moshe protests that there must be better people and between the time that Aaron becomes Kohen, something very significant took place to the Jewish people. And what am I thinking about?
The incident with the
golden calf. So, what does Aaron do in that instance? So again, let's get the scene down in a proper way. The people feel afraid. The people feel vulnerable. Moshe, who did take them out of Egypt in the end, of course with God's help, has disappeared. Moshe said he would be back, and Moshe's not back yet. And the people then, now there's one more thing. Before Moshe went up, he told the people, if you have any questions, speak to Hur and Aaron. They're in charge. From that moment on, we never hear about Hur again. He disappears in the Torah. Hur was apparently a very important person. The reason I say that is that when Moshe climbs the mountain where he prays for the people as the war takes place below against Amalek, Yoshua is the one who fights below. Two people were told, hold Moshe's hands. And we don't know who has the right and who has the left, but who are those people? Aaron and Hur. So Hur is arguably Moshe's right-hand man. Hur, by the way, comes from the tribe of Judah, which means that Hur is a prototype of the family of Judah, the family of David, and eventually of Mashiach. That's the lineage that you're talking about. Hur disappears. Later on, Hur's grandson, Bezalel, will be the one who will build the temple. Just as later on, David will be the one to build the temple. Solomon will build the temple, and eventually their descendant, the Messiah, will build the temple. So Hur is a very significant individual. Moshe goes up and Moshe says, you have any issues, speak to Hur, speak to Aaron. We never hear from Hur again. The rabbis fill in the information and say that the people were very frightened. They came to Hur and said, build for us an idol. Build for us a golden calf. And Hur says, over my dead body, and they murder him. Aaron sees this take place, and they come to Aaron then, and Aaron says, fine, you want a golden calf? No problem. I'll build for you an idol. I'll build for you a golden calf. No problem. So, if what I'm saying is accurate, and even without all the background, that Aaron built the golden calf is written in the Torah, Aaron builds the golden calf and becomes the Kohen Gadol, becomes a Kohen, and his descendants become Kohanim. Pinchas kills a man and a woman, and he now is told that he either becomes a Kohen or continues to be Kohen, becomes a rehabilitated Kohen, however we want to read that. So at face value, there is a certain parallel over here between the two situations. But that's only at face value. In terms of the essence of the issue, these things are very, very different. How so? So let's take this down to two things, which is basically one of the most essential struggles that take place. There's something which is called truth, and there's something which is called peace. Peace and truth have a very difficult time of coexisting. In order, if a person lives a life of total and absolute truth, they may find themselves very lonely. They may find themselves unable to find other people that accept the same absolute truth, other people who are able to tolerate the same absolute truth. On the other hand, to achieve peace, very often truth gets trampled upon. How exactly do truth and peace coexist? Matter of fact, the rabbis tell us long before creation, God actually consulted with truth and says, should we create the world? And truth said, absolutely not. Because man cannot live up to real truth. Can peace, yes, peace, should the world be created also? No, because man cannot really achieve peace. How can we work the two together? Now, I want you to think this through for a second and think what Pinchas did. Pinchas is a man of truth. What does he see? He sees something wrong. What does he then do? He acts viciously, violently, decisively. Which means, do we have any illusions that what he's doing over here is sitting and negotiating and let's work this out and let everybody go home happy? Right? Is that what Pinchas is doing, or quite the opposite? Pinchas is using truth. He's motivated by truth. So he utilizes truth, but it's very interesting. What does God then give him afterwards? He gives him a blessing of peace. Okay? Hold on to that. On the other hand, what does Aaron do? Aaron sees a situation where they just killed one person. And who knows how many more people the mob will kill until they calm themselves down. So what does he do? He creates idolatry. Now, I want you to appreciate, from a Jewish perspective, it would be very difficult for you to come upon something which was more of an untruth than idolatry. Right? Well, from a Jewish perspective, what's ultimate truth? That there's one God. What's the biggest lie? Idolatry. So therefore, while Pinchas kills for the sake of truth, and at that moment tramples upon peace, what does Aaron do? Aaron commits an incredible untruth for the sake of peace in order to try to smooth things over and to buy more time until Moshe will come back. Which means if you think about it, these are absolute opposites. So even though both of them acted in order, and therefore I said acted like a Kohen, no, which is really the quintessential gesture of a Kohen? Is it one of truth or is it one of peace? Is the quintessential action of a Kohen one of truth or one of peace? So we have an argument over here. I would say that it's one of peace. Matter of fact, when the Kohen makes the blessing, what blessing does he make? The blessing he gives is the blessing to give peace. Yisim lecha shalom. Where in the prayers does that come? Right before the word sim shalom. Give peace. Which blessing it concludes that whole section, including what? Where does Berachas Konim? It comes in right by. Hamavrechas amo Yisrael b'shalom. Which is the whole section is one of peace. Let's go back to the temple. The temple is a place where man who, when he sins, comes and tries to work things out with God. Does he say, God, give me some of your truth? Does he say, God, let's make things up, let's negotiate? When you come in front of God in the temple, do you say, God, I want absolute truth from you, even if it means my death? Is that what people do? Or they say, God, don't judge me with truth. Rather, have compassion. Yes.
Supposed to be judged in your own merits, so it's not truth, it's your own peace. It's your own truth, which is peace.
It's your own truth. It's not really your own truth, no, which means, right. again, I'm not going to let you get away with that. Because look, historically, if a person did something wrong, and they turned to God and said, I'm sorry. So now, historical truth, you did that or you didn't do that? Right. So if you say, give me truth, what should the result be? Right. So, by the way, think about it. Judaism loves the concept of tshuva. What does tshuva mean? Return to God. Don't you realize that tshuva is an affront to truth? Yes or no? It's a total affront to truth. Because what are you saying? All those things that I did, I'm sorry. So what? You're sorry. Why should your being sorry have any impact on what you did? You did it. That's truth. But somehow we stand in front of God. We say, God, give us compassion. Compassion is peace. Compassion is working things out. Working things out, you know what? I'll ignore what you did. Yeah.
Thirdly, we're not interested in truth. The whole use of 12 core prayers are about disregard our sins, ignore everything we've done, and using loopholes to trick God into forgiving us.
Well, I'm not sure if we're tricking God or I'm not sure how much God is being tricked.
Like a lot of prayers with loopholes.
I'm not even sure if it's loopholes as much as... It's an understanding that our current relationship with God, for whatever reason, is more important than what really happened in the past. And that again, by the way, that's incredibly liberating. It's liberating that God who's aware of the past, present, and future, which means he's even worse than we're thinking. Because I can say, you know what, God's gonna ignore the past, make believe it didn't happen. But not only did it happen, I may do it again tomorrow, right? And God knows if you're going to do it again. And we're saying to God, please just judge me by the way that I feel right now, because I'm really sincere today. And God says, okay. So what is that? It means that when it comes to this issue of this tension between truth and peace, which again, seem almost impossible to reconcile, the ladies in the room, I want to ask you a question. When my wife says to me, do I look fat in this dress? What am I supposed to answer? Why? What happened to truth? Truth isn't important? Are you telling me to lie to my wife? So you're telling me that you want to be lied to? So my answer to her be, what are you talking about? You look anorexic to me. No, that shouldn't be the answer. But you see the challenges of having a peaceful relationship if you always speak truth? Again, how exactly do you reconcile these two things? How do you reconcile peace and truth? By the way, one of my rabbis once said that the only way that this can ever happen is when the Messiah, that's part of what the Messiah has to do. The Messiah will have to teach us how we put together those two things. Because, and that's what I was alluding to before, the person who's totally holding on to truth will have a very hard time having peace. And the person who has peace will have a very hard time having truth. So we go back over here and we see that Pinchas is actually a man who acts with truth. And therefore it's very interesting that what God gives him is peace. Now, let's go back a second to Aaron. Aaron, because of his behavior, becomes the Kohen. Now, I could have said that his behavior should have taken away the possibility of him being a Kohen. Think about it. Instead of worshiping God, what was he guilty of? He was guilty of worshiping the golden calf. That's a lie. It's totally untrue. But still, apparently, that attempt to go for peace, which, by the way, is incredibly difficult to justify on a moral level, God accepts. But by the way, we also don't know what the price he may have been paid. I mean, later on he has sons that die, and it's not exactly clear what exactly is the real origin for that. I mean, there's all kinds of things in his life which may not work out very well, but nonetheless, Aaron is accepted as the Kohen Gadol afterwards. Now, the Talmud tells us something very interesting. And the reason why this is interesting is not so much what he does, but the verse that it quotes to justify it. Hillel, one of the great rabbis, teaches us that we should be like the students of Aaron. Ohev shalom v'rodev shalom. Love peace and pursue peace. Explaining that, there is a rabbinic teaching found in a source known as Avos Rebbi Nasan that says, Ohev shalom ketzad, how do you love peace? Melamid shia adam ohev shalom b'Yisrael, a person should love peace among the Jewish people. Bein kol echad ve'echad kederech shia Aaron ohev shalom. You should love peace the way that Aaron loved peace. Bein kol echad ve'echad sh'ne'amar, and it quotes a verse. Listen to the verse it quotes. Toras emes haisa b'fihu. The Torah of truth was in his mouth. Now you know what upsets me? It upsets me that it uses this verse. Because what verse did it quote? Truth should be in his mouth. And then what does it go on to say? It goes on to tell us how Aaron used to work within the community. If somebody was a sinner, he would befriend the sinner. And the sinner would say, listen, if Aaron's my friend, then how can I do such a thing? And then it says that if two people were fighting, he would go over to one of them and say, listen, this other guy is really torn up inside, and you really have to make up with him. And the other guy, he would tell the other fellow, you know, this other guy really is torn up, he really wants to make up with you. And hold it, that's Torah's emes? That's truth? Tell me that Aaron sacrificed truth to achieve peace. But the verse that it quotes is Torah's emes b'fihu, that the Torah of truth was in his mouth. Which, by the way, is part of a larger quote, which I'll quote a little bit of it. It's from the book of Malachi, where it says, my covenant might be with Levi, says the Lord of hosts. My covenant was with him of life and peace, and I gave to him and fear, and he feared me and was not afraid of my name. The law of truth was in his mouth, and unrighteousness was not found in his lips. He walked with me in peace and righteousness and did turn away many from iniquity. From the priest's lips should keep knowledge and should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. The Hebrew word here is not messenger, is malach Hashem Tzivakos. A malach could either be a messenger or an angel. And this verse over here, or these couple of verses, it fused together peace and truth and life and sort of combined all these things together. And as I said, I find it initially perplexing that it will quote the verse about truth and therefore tell us how Aaron acted. So obviously there's a much deeper point over here. Let me try to identify it. There's a passage in rabbinic literature that says that God's seal is truth. His seal. You know, like a family can have a family seal. What do they call that?
Crest.
A crest. So God's crest is truth. That's his seal. We're also told in the Talmud that God's name is peace, shalom. A matter of fact, the Talmud tells us that in the bathroom, which is a place which isn't necessarily holy, one should not say the word shalom. You don't say the word shalom because it's one of God's names. So the Maharal, who was one of the great philosophers slash Kabbalists, tells us, but there's no objection about saying peace, emes, in the bathroom. Because that's only God's seal, and this is God's name. So what exactly is going on? Or go back to what somebody said before. When I asked about, if my wife asked me if she looks fat, then you said it. What did you say? You're allowed to alter the truth for the sake of peace. You said shalom bayis, right? That's what you said. You said shalom bayis. You're allowed to finesse the truth for the sake of peace. Why? So based on the what the Maharal says, and I want you to understand this, based on the Maharal, it's not just that peace is more important than truth, but you realize I could have said it like that. That when you're in a relationship, sometimes it's not so important for you to say your own personal truth. Sometimes that things work out, the greater good is more important than a personal truth. When I say it like that, then I'm explaining it in the sense of that there's a hierarchy and that peace is more important than truth. The Maharal doesn't say it like that. What the Maharal seems to say is that peace is a greater truth than truth. Did you follow that, or was that obscure? That peace is a greater truth than truth, which means, let's go back. When the two people were fighting, and Aaron says he wants to make up, and this guy wants to make up, did they really want to make up? If you would have asked them, they would have said no. If you would have put them on a lie detector, they would have said no. But you know what Aaron was saying? See, you could say that Aaron is very naive. He thinks everyone wants to get along and so on and so forth. But Aaron is not naive. What Aaron, though, sees is deep down in their hearts. Meaning, why don't we get along? That's a very serious question. Why don't we get along? Because we're afraid. We are. We're afraid of letting people see how we really feel. Guys, do you realize the tragedy of your generation? I'm older than you, so it's different. Do you realize the tragedy of your generation? You live in a generation that people are more prepared to take their clothes off and to share their bodies than they are to share their souls. Because to share your soul with somebody is incredibly frightening. To share your essence with somebody, that's incredibly frightening. Share your body with somebody, that's not as scary. Again, I want you to think of that a second. I mean, theoretically, one should have been a metaphor of the other and they should have been interrelated. But in order to share your soul with somebody, you need to be in touch with your soul. In order to be in touch with your soul, there's an incredible amount of static which takes place outside that you have to learn how to shut off all the static and to get into what really is you and not all these other things going on. That's a lot of work. People don't necessarily want to work that hard. In order to really love another person, you need to know who you are. You need to know who they are. In order to have a really deep relationship, you have to go deep into the soul level. Why don't we love more people? Because we're afraid of getting hurt. That's the fear. We're afraid that other people are going to step on us and people are going to hurt us. And we don't want to put ourselves in a situation where we're going to be vulnerable. Because what's going to happen when we get vulnerable? We're going to end up getting a lot of pain. And if there's nothing else that we learn, because we're all very sophisticated, we learn that we want to avoid pain. Because pain isn't pleasant. So to avoid pain, we build up defenses. When we build up defenses, we sort of block things out and block people out from getting really close to who we are. And we hide our soul and we replace deep relationships for all kinds of other relationships. And I'm not talking only about sexuality. I'm talking about all kinds of levels that we're afraid of really showing who we are. Because, as I said, that's the most vulnerable we can possibly be. And why do I hate the other person? I hate them because they hurt me once, and I'm afraid they're going to hurt me again, and I'm not going to let myself get hurt again. And two people who are in a quarrel with one another, each of them are feeling vulnerable, and it's their vulnerability that stops them from being able to display love. Let me ask you, if you didn't feel vulnerable at all, and you felt absolutely loved and taken care of and warm, would you be able to love more people? Of course. So what prevents us from being able to love? The fact that we feel so vulnerable. And we live in a world that people today feel more vulnerable than any point in history. And it's good because it keeps psychologists and psychiatrists and the pharmaceutical company, everyone's making a lot of money on us. But it all comes down to this core problem of us feeling vulnerable. And what does Aaron do? Aaron sees two people and fighting. So is Aaron naive? Listen, he really wants to make up? No, he's not naive. What does Aaron see? He sees straight into the soul. And he sees past the bluster and past, you know, the defense mechanisms and past everything. Deep into the soul, what does Aaron see? He wants to make up with him. And that's why he walks over to one guy and says, you know what, he wants to make up with you. Even though that guy himself could pass a lie detector test, when if he's asked, do you want to make up, the guy would say, absolutely not. Because what's being tested in the lie detector? His vulnerability is being tested. What's being tested? The external person is being tested. But how exactly do you take a lie detector on somebody's soul? And Aaron is a Kohen Gadol. He's a doctor of the soul. And he sees straight into the soul and says, he wants to make up with you. And you know what else he's saying to him? You want to make up with him. And you know what happens? They make up. But why do they make up? Because Aaron, it's not that peace is more important than truth. That's also true. But what is it? It's that peace is the greatest manifestation of truth. When all the various lies that surround us get stripped away, all that they're left with then, at the core level, is this total, total aspect of love. According to the Kabbalistic tradition, Pinchas never dies. According to even the simple tradition, Pinchas lives for hundreds of years. That's this covenant of peace that he gets. According to the Kabbalistic understanding, he gets either reincarnated or somehow he becomes a man named Eliyahu. The Kabbalists point out that the name Eliyahu is a very interesting name. Because the first couple letters, Aleph Lamed, represent God's name of Elohim. God's name of Elohim is judgment. The last couple of name of letters of the name, Yud Hey Vav, comes from God's other name, which represents compassion. Eliyahu is a hybrid between strictness and compassion. Pinchas acts with strictness, clinging to truth, even though lives are taken away, blood is spilled, God gives him a covenant of peace. This covenant of peace then creates this new personality named Eliyahu. Eliyahu, as far as, again, tradition tells us, later on never dies, becomes an angel and goes floating up into heaven. And how interesting was this verse where it talks about this covenant of peace and that was given. The one in Malachi, it says, and listen to the words of truth from his mouth, for he's an angel of God, or Malach Hashem Tzavakos, messenger of God or angel of God. The next chapter within the book of Malachi goes to the very last verse in all of prophets and all of Navi. The second to the last verse reads, Hinei anochi sholeach lechem es Eliyahu hanavi lefnei bo hayom hagadol v'hanora. I'm going to send to you Eliyahu before this great frightening day. V'heishiv lev avos abanim v'lev banim alavosam. And he's going to reunite fathers and children, children and fathers. The last Mishnah in a book which is called Edyos talks about a debate that took place by what the role of Eliyahu is. I'm going to go to the very end. Chachamim Omrim, the sages say, the purpose of Eliyahu is lo l'rachik v'lo l'karev, not to send people away. Not, it's interesting. The earlier opinion said, you know what Eliyahu is going to do? At the end of days, he's going to come and he's going to start making order. He's going to say, oh, you think you're Jewish? You're not really Jewish. Your mother really was, your great-great-grandmother wasn't Jewish. You don't think you're Jewish, you really are Jewish. By the way, there's a lot to say about this. The rabbis say that in the end of days, a lot of confusion is going to take place. People think that they are, aren't. People think they aren't, are. All kinds of confusion. That's what Eliyahu is going to do. If you say that that's what Eliyahu does, what's his role according to that opinion? Truth. He's going to come in and lay the truth at people who are not ready even to take it, and he's going to be the absolute arbiter in terms of truth. That's the first opinion. The last opinion of the Chum, he says, no, he doesn't come to bring people closer, farther. He doesn't come to do that. The purpose of Eliyahu is Elo la'asot shalom ba'olam. The purpose of Eliyahu is to make peace in the world. And what verse does it quote? Shenemar, hineni shaleich lechem es Eliyahu navi v'gomer v'heishiv lev avos abanim v'lev banim alavosam. That the purpose of Eliyahu is to create, you know, they talk about a generation gap with this division between parents and children. So that Eliyahu is going to come and fuse the gaps. What he's going to do is cause this incredible reconciliation between people that weren't able to get along. He's going to bring all the children back to their parents back to the children. He's going to bring about a reconciliation. And ultimately what he's saying is that the purpose of Eliyahu is to create peace in the world. Which means what Pinchas did is an action where on one level he acts like a Kohen. What level is that? He sees a plague, he moves in, he stops it. But on the other hand, what he did was clinging to truth and trampling upon peace. What Aaron does to become Kohen is he clings to peace and he tramples upon truth. What Eliyahu is going to be able to do is be Eli and Yahu, merge together what we call rachamim or chesed and din, merge together between truth and peace. That's an incredible thing to be able to reconcile the two. Perhaps that's the lesson over here, is that when we live in a world and we see truth trampled all around us, we see peace trampled all around us. You know, sometimes I think that, okay, at least if we had one of them, it would be okay, but we live in a world where both of them get stepped on. You can just look at the news from yesterday. You don't have to go any further. But we're told that the day will come when Eliyahu, who is the beneficiary of the blessing that was given to Pinchas, who clung to truth, God says to him, that's great. Now let me give you a blessing of peace. And where does that manifest? That manifests in Eliyahu. And when Eliyahu is able to bring those two together, that becomes the point that we usher in the Messianic age. May God bless all of us that we're able to live to see that day. Have a good Shabbos.